Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Reminder, we Zoom this show the day before, so if something should happen, you're not going to be hearing it on Thursday, but you may be able to regroup on Friday. We begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Fidman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I guess we pulled the short straw in New Hampshire. President Trump is coming to Portsmouth, New Hampshire on Saturday. I think he's the definition of unethical, of traitor, of unpatriotic. Maybe that's why you really need to hear the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vinman. You'll be hearing it now and until the election. Vinman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So as you know, I love the conversation.com. I'm probably one of its biggest miners of information. I'm so glad that it now exists all over the world. It brings PhDs and professors who are brilliant. I don't go to school with them and I'm too old to go back to school. Maybe that's not true. But I get to sort of mine it for fabulous information. My audience knows this and my guest does not know this, but I own a huge house that I inherited. And in order to keep this house, I've had to monetize it. Nita Crawford, and I'm going to tell you who she is. And Nita, I, as a result, rent to law students on my second floor because the law school, UNH Law, does not have a dorm. That has brought young people in from all over the country. And I'm going to tell you right now, Nita, it's brought young people in from all over the world, from Ghana, from China. And right now, currently, I have a student from Pakistan. And so I have a variety of students that live with me. So I am looking at the opening of college and law school and universities in a very intimate way because it touches my life on a daily basis. And I adore these kids and I want to make sure they're safe, but I also am concerned about them going back to school. So joining us right now is Nita Crawford. She's a professor of political science and the department chair at Boston University. She is one of those people that wrote at theconversation.com and I am so grateful. This is her piece from July 3rd. Ethical challenges loom over decisions to resume in-person college classes. So welcome to the program, Nita. And I feel like I'm being sandwiched. Across the street, I have an elementary school that's figuring out how the hell they open up school there. And then on my second floor, I have law students and three blocks up, I have the university. So I feel like this isn't just other people's stories. It is so intimate to my life. So I would love to have you sort of share with us what I think is a really important conversation because it is not a switch, it's not open on, and it has so many other underlying problems that I think a lot of us need to be aware of as these very challenging decisions are being made, especially at the college level, which is actually very different from a public school education.
Well, thank you, Arnie, for having me on the program, and I can't emphasize how important it is to talk about these issues because no university is an island. You know this in your community. But as I live in Boston, the Boston area, and we have about, like many other large cities in the US, 100 universities and colleges and technical schools. There are 20 million college and university students in the United States who could potentially be going back to campus in person or trying to do some online hybrid education. That's a significant movement of people if half of them are moving any significant distance. And it's also a significant challenge if they don't go back to school. So the part of the argument that I'm making in this piece is about moral responsibility. That is, who should be responsible for these decisions? Now, universities and colleges have been making them by themselves for the most part, and only taking their plans to city and state officials once they've determined what they'd like to do. But my argument is really that this is a public policy challenge. The moral responsibility for the risk-taking should be discussed in communities and at the city, county, and state level, as well as the federal level. So,
and from your perspective, I just want to remind you, you mentioned the 20 million, you mentioned the idea of opening, but as I said before, I have an elementary school across the street, and then I have UNH. Well, the elementary school across the street, we know where the students come from. We know their community. We know how far they have to travel to go to school. It's a couple blocks. It's a bus ride. When you're talking about, for example, in Boston, where you have so many educational institutions that bring people in from all over the world, let alone all over the country, it isn't just about how are things doing in Boston? How are things doing in Massachusetts? When you're bringing kids in from Florida and Texas and Mississippi and everywhere else, it isn't just about what happens on your campus. It's what is being drawn to your campus that also is an ethical dilemma for schools and needs to be thought of in a bigger way than just at the university level.
That's right. Boston isn't alone. Chicago, LA, New York. There, in New York alone, there are tens of thousands of students who will be returning to the universities if they follow the mandate to have in-person classes. So, yes, it is a problem of movement across regions and state lines. And, you know, then there's the logistical challenges of quarantining people. Should you take that to be the next step? And if you don't take that to be the next step, the problems of testing and getting notices on testing. So my argument is really on several levels. One is the precautionary principle. We don't really know all the risks, but we need to take care not to step into the unknowns, blinding, you know, with our eyes shut, with wishful thinking. And I think that's really what I've seen lately is a lot of wishful thinking. And then secondly, this idea that universities aren't an island, that they have economic and health connections to the communities that they're in. And thirdly, that these decisions aren't, because they're not islands, they're actually public policy decisions that includes public health and economics. So the tremendous pressures to open, not just from Trump, but from the universities and colleges themselves, may mean that people are waiting the wrong things. The pressures to open come from the desire that students have to get back to campus. You know, my own daughter wants desperately to go back to school because the online education, which included losing her studio art classes, was so inadequate. I mean, you can't do art at home without the right materials and right feedback. And her other classes in the social sciences were also subpar because of the loss there of the community to have a good conversation with. So, but they want to get back. As a parent, I'm concerned about sending my child back to a place that has optimistic, wishful thinking assumptions, and every parent faces this choice. So universities want to make sure that they're safe, or at least appear to be safe, and they have optimistic assumptions about how this safety can occur.
May I just stop you here for one quick second, Lena? And that is, because we're talking about the student, the young person, the desire of them to go back to school, how inadequate it is to Zoom. But what we are seeing in places like Texas, what we are seeing in places like Florida, is that now the driver of COVID-19, now the number of people that have been hospitalized, now it turns out it's the behavior of exactly that demographic that we are talking about. And that behavior is not the behavior of someone like Arnie Arneson, who's 66, who has, you know, friends who are 72, who are all like, okay, we're going to shelter in place, we're going to order our food. These are young people who've been told, oh, but you won't die from this. You're sort of in, so they've been getting these sort of bad public policy and even health messages. It's a more vulnerable population than we knew, but I don't think they've been, quote unquote, Nita, taught that.
Right. Well, they didn't learn that that they could actually get seriously ill with permanent long-term consequences, including brain damage.
Yes.
The brain damage from COVID-19 is just now really being understood, the neurological consequences. No person wants to send their kid or go to school and then suffer brain damage from an illness where you don't have adequate oxygen to your brain, you may live. It's not, I think, just the behavior of the students we have to be concerned about. To me, universities are great places for kids to get together, do all sorts of crazy things, but primarily what they're doing is going to class and living in dorms, interacting with people who live in dorms. Research shows that just going to class is a risk because of the networks that you establish when you move from class to class. It's very hard to live in isolated pods and interact in isolated pods just by going to class. The dorms themselves are often places where, if they're high-rise dorms, they're elevators where people congregate to wait to get into the elevator to go up to their floor. We know that ventilation in older classroom buildings is often poor, and in newer buildings, you can't sometimes open windows to increase the ventilation. Universities are putting in effort, for instance, like Arizona State, to have awnings and fans so they can have outdoor classes, where the issue there is heat. Cornell will be putting up tents for students to meet outside, where the issue will be rain and cold. This is a much larger problem than can be solved by changing the HVAC, the air conditioning, the ventilation systems in a few buildings. It's simply the structure of campus and what students do on it, which creates the sort of petri dish-like environment, which could lead to outbreaks, which could then stress not only campus health services, but community health services, not to speak of the potential for the students transiting, you know, for the first time to the community or getting it afterwards to transmit the virus to members of the community through their
One of the things I've been learning about is that we know that from a technological perspective, the Zoom, the Skype, the online learning, it's been very, very hard with young people. And I mean young, like elementary school and even middle school students. And there's also the technological divide. There's all this other stuff. When I think of the groups that are, the 20 million that are going to college, I see them as more sophisticated, more socially oriented, from they know how to use social networks. They all know how to, you know, facilitate themselves when it comes to online learning. But now we have a couple of issues here that you raise in your piece. And then another piece that I told you was filed just this morning at the conversation. And that is that my school, UNH Law, is talking about having the accordion effect. And you know what I mean by that, Eva. That is, well, we'll do some online, we'll do some in person. We're going to constantly observe and make changes and be nimble. And I believe it was in your piece, Nita, that you said, really? And how are you making those accordion decisions? What are the triggers that are going to decide when you're in school, when you're not in school? Again, the lack of transparency, unfortunately, undermines trust, which is part of the problem here with dealing with this pandemic.
That's right. So if we know that the infection rates on a campus are at or below the community infection rate, then we'll be more or less comfortable, depending on what the community infection rate is. But if the infection rate is higher on campus, then we can expect that to ripple out to the community. Parents will want to pull their kids home. Okay, but we know from when students went home in March, they also brought the virus home with them. So it's not just going to campus, it's coming home from campus. Really, nothing fundamental has changed at a medical level. We know that there are semi-effective treatments that can shorten the duration of this or treat some of the issues that come along with a serious COVID-19 infection. But the basics haven't changed. So we need a public policy response that reflects this. Universities, and what I'm trying to say is universities have been left essentially on their own to make decisions which they shouldn't be left on their own to make.
And a monetary decision is part of the problem here, because what you're doing is you're not sure what kind of support you're getting from the feds. You're not sure what kind of support you're going to be getting from state and local. We can assume none. So you're also making a decision where a lot of schools, they may not be Harvard, they may not be Yale, they may not be Princeton, where they have these huge endowments, and they can weather a year of indecision. They can weather a year of, you know, basically telling people that we're going to, you know, either cut the cost because it's going to be online, so you don't have to show up. But a lot of schools, they don't have that luxury. And again, because there's no leadership coming, especially from the federal government, there is no way to make an informed decision, because you're also looking at the choice between a school surviving and a school failing. And that's frightening.
we've been led here by short-term thinking and the short-term idea that you must get campuses functioning for economic reasons is going to then push out the long-term thinking. But in the long run, if many students, faculty, and staff are sick and some of them die, this will turn out to be a financial disaster as well. No one will go back in the second semester. No one will wisely return. And then, you know, yes, universities, many of them and colleges fly too close to the sun in terms of their budgets. And that's been a structural problem at campuses. There are many reasons to think about cutting certain aspects of university and college budgets, which may not be, you know, I wouldn't spend the money this way. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But much of what happens is actually quite important. So is there a way to think about in the long run, some long-term cuts that would help, but also a short-term infusion of cash from the federal government? State universities are, for once, in a better position because they will get help. State universities and colleges will likely, many of them, not be facing the same sorts of stresses that the sort of small and medium and even semi-large colleges and universities will face. They'll get through probably many of them, but there's 4,000 colleges and universities in the U.S., and many of them just are too close to income, that is revenue and expenses. It's just too tight a line.
I asked you, and at the time I asked you yesterday, if you had seen the new requirement coming down from the federal government through ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they have made a decision on July 6th, everyone, so this is very timely, and you're just beginning to hear it, regarding international students in the U.S. And I'm going to read from the article that was just filed this morning, July 8th, at The Conversation. And that he wrote, based on what I know, of course, this is the part of the problem. This is such a moving target, Nita. I mean, I could call you on Friday and they'll probably be a different directive. But anyway, based on what I know about the power and influence of higher education in the U.S., this decision that will affect more than, I think, 870,000 international students. That's how many students we currently have in the United States. And under this new rule, international students may stay in the country only if they attend a college that is offering in-person courses. So if they decide to do all online, for example, there's a school in Manchester called Southern New Hampshire University. They made a decision a month and a half ago that the entire academic year will be online. They also said we'll charge you less because it's going to be online as opposed to being in. They made that decision now, and they have a lot of foreign students, especially from China, by the way, and a lot of them have had to go home because they're from China, but they have a lot of international students. This is adding salt to a wound. It is adding financial fiascos because a lot of those international students pay full freight. And now the schools are being told that if you don't have in-person classes, those students must either transfer or go home. And financially, that's another blow, Nita, another blow.
Right. Again, there's a longer-term question about how universities are funded. You know, colleges and universities got $14 billion in assistance May, I think, of this year. That was inadequate, given the scale of the university system as a sector. It's hundreds of thousands of people either benefit directly from working in universities and colleges, or indirectly because their communities have one or maybe several colleges and universities which buoy their local economy. This is an entire sector, and these sort of willy-nilly decisions which hurt the sector in the guise of sort of making it function better are counterproductive. It's extreme stress and hardship for the students that we're supposed to be caring about. I know of, not just because they're my students, but because they're friends of my kid, many students in China who now just don't know what they're going to do.
I know.
And that's an education interrupted, but it's not just Chinese students, and perhaps Mr. Trump doesn't care about Chinese people as much as other people, but it's students from all over the world. We have graduate students who we need to try to get back to university so they can finish their education who are from Europe.
Well, it's a brain drain. It's a brain drain. These are people that are working in research. These are, I mean, these aren't just, they're not just students. You know, they're not putting a backpack on and going to class and coming home. We're talking about PhDs. We're talking about double PhDs. We're talking about, you know, people who are interning. And again, this is just evil. This isn't, it isn't informed. It isn't rational. There's no purpose. It is anti-immigrant, which is everything that defines this administration. It is anti-financial. It's frankly, Nita, you know what this is. It's anti-elite. We know that Donald Trump has been playing every card possible for this November election. And there is an intellectual hatred. They don't like scientists. They don't trust the doctors. They're talking about these intellectual elites. And in a lot of ways, this just sort of permeates everything he does. And to see this as you're making these decisions, you mentioned that there were two appeals to this by what, Harvard and MIT? What are they bringing up in their appeal to this edict coming out of ICE?
Well, I haven't finished reading their appeal, but they're pointing out that there's really very little time to make these decisions. And basically, 9 days after they were told by ICE what they needed to do, they're supposed to submit plans. People don't work that quickly, and you know, individual choices shouldn't be forced that quickly. The urgency here is actually a faux urgency. It's a crisis of their own making. In their filing, Harvard and MIT note that it's extremely risky to have classes indoors because of the ventilation problems. They're acknowledging that, and that's why they've gone to reduced class sizes. Right, they're trying to do some social distancing just by simply not bringing people to campus. And those are wise decisions, which would diminish the risk of in-person education. But that's as far as I've gotten with the filing.
Yeah. No. This is a moving train. You know that, Nita, and I know that. People are just figuring out what are the consequences of this. You know, people who are hearing this story are going, oh, it's an immigrant, it doesn't matter, it's a foreign student, who cares? Just to let you know, if you see the percentage of students that we used to have from around the world back maybe only 8 or 10 years ago, and see the percentage this year, the numbers have dramatically dropped. So we're seeing competition for international students here. That is not good in a lot of ways. We want to bring the best and brightest here because it doesn't hurt that they're educated here. It helps their country. It clearly helps us. This is going to be another driver away. And then on top of that, I just saw a statistic that my daughter lives in Shanghai, so I'm very sort of China aware. And that China right now, if for every 10 students that are being trained outside of their home country, 1 in 10 is now going to China. That was never true before. China was sending their students everywhere, but students were not coming to China. Well, China is now going to see this as another opportunity to step in. I don't want to be anti-Chinese. I have a Chinese son-in-law, but I just want everyone to know there is an advantage to this. And look what Donald Trump is doing. Not only is he squandering understanding that advantage, but he's asking you at these academic institutions, Nita, to make a decision on a dime that implicates every aspect of the school and the communities in which they operate.
Arnie, I don't think it's just Trump. I think that the Congress has failed here. And there is an anti-intellectualism among, you know, members of the more Republicans than Democrats. But there's a sort of, you know, idea that there's a liberal elite who's telling everybody what to do and that they're, you know, centered in universities. I think that's really not what we're talking about here. We're talking about life and death of people and local and regional economies. And we're also talking about moral responsibility, the moral hazard that is being put in train here by forcing people to at universities to densely pack students into dormitories when we know that if we densely pack anyone anywhere, like a church or a subway car or a bus, the likelihood of transmission goes up. It's not just the people who first get the disease, like maybe it's the young people, but it's all the rest of us.
And I think one of the things, I need to let you go, Nita, but one of the things that I'm listening to you is, you know, actions have consequences. And I want to start posting the list of the consequences to the action, even the action by ICE, just the most recent action, because it actually touches on everything you wrote about in your article, because it touches on all those decisions. It's not a decision about the 5% of the 20 million students. It's about forcing colleges to make premature decisions that are not based on the science and the changing science, Nita. You were just mentioning that we're talking about potential brain damage for young people that contract COVID. Well, we were telling them that they would survive, they'd be fine, they wouldn't have any of the negative consequences. Well, now to suddenly realize at age 21, because you got sick, it isn't about a virus, it could be about brain damage or permanent lung damage. That changes all the information, and the beauty of science is that it's not rigid. The beauty of science is it constantly evolves as new information comes in. Donald Trump is demanding a rigid decision at a time as the information we're getting is evolving and changing and becoming more sophisticated and frankly more horrifying. And I just think the morality point that you make is incredibly, incredibly important. I can't thank you enough. It's we're living in challenging times. I hope Congress steps up and finds their voice. I hope they overturn this decision by ICE. Her piece, Ethical Challenges Loom Over Decisions to Resume In-Person College Classes. Nita Crawford is a professor of political science and the department chair at Boston University. I'm behind you. Whatever I can do to help make
Thank
sure people
much.
Understand.
Thank
Ciao.
You.
All right, everyone, stick around. We're going to go from here to talking about migration. There is a theme to this show. We'll be right back.
When it comes to runoff, less is more. On this current cast. Too much rain and too many people using a lot of water can overwhelm aging stormwater systems. That can cause them to overflow and dump pollution into rivers. Instead of rebuilding systems or adding bigger pipes, many cities are turning to green infrastructure to meet clean water standards. By creating green space where plants and soils can capture rainwater and runoff.
Less is being sent through the pipes, and there's a less chance for overflows.
That's Katie Rousseau of the nonprofit American Rivers. She says rain gardens, storage ponds, and permeable pavement, which treat stormwater at its source, are a real solution and cost less than fixing old systems. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1900. That was the day that folk singer Malvina Reynolds was born to a Jewish family in San Francisco. Her parents were socialists and operated a tailor shop. Malvina learned the price of speaking out for what you believe in at a young age. Her parents opposed U.S. entry into World War I. Because of this, Malvina's high school would not issue her a diploma. She was able to still go to college at Berkeley, where she eventually earned her PhD. She married carpenter and labor organizer William Bud Reynolds. She became a prolific folk singer, playing around the Los Angeles area. During the 1960s, she wrote about songs supporting civil rights and labor rights. Her song, Free Enterprise, offers the lyrics, "The air you breathe is poison. The food you eat is worse. The dollars in your paycheck are pennies in your purse. There's nothing free about it. You pay at every turn, except the guys in Wall Street who have the stuff to burn. They had to make new brain machines to count their profits rise. But since there's always room for more, they can still make their profits soar. A little war does wonders for free enterprise." Perhaps her most well-known song is Little Boxes. The song was inspired by driving by hillside houses in Daly City, California. It talks about the conformity of middle-class suburbia.
Where they are put in boxes and they come out all the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
And a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been. Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. Road again, like a band of gypsies, we go down the highway. the road again. I just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again.
To part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we Zoom this show on Wednesday morning, so if something should happen on Wednesday night, we'll probably be discussing it on Friday. So I got sent a book. I get sent a lot of books, I have to tell you. This book changed my head, and that's a real compliment to the author. The title of the book, The Next Great Migration: The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Moon. We're being joined right now by Sonia Shah. She is a science journalist and a prize-winning author of a book that just came out a couple of years ago, How Prescient Are You? Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. And of course, she goes from where everybody wants to call her. They want to talk about her old book, Pandemic. And yet in some ways, your new book, not only does it build on your old book of Pandemic, but it threads together the challenges we are facing in steroids at this very moment. So Sonia Shah, I don't know who you are. I don't know, what bulb you're looking through, but you seem to understand when to start writing about things that are happening right now. And I am so grateful that you can look around corners. So welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, and thank you for your kind words.
This is a book about migration, but it's not just a book about, when I think migration, I think immigration. I think undocumented, I immediately go there. But you look at migration as it's existed probably in perpetuity, in the sense that all species have migrated. It's the nature of living in this world. And it's not necessarily something to fear. Maybe it is something to embrace, and that maybe it is about survival. And that we have to understand it. And it isn't just toads and butterflies and coyotes that migrate. Yes, they are a species, but guess what? So is Homo sapiens. The title of an article I saw as I was getting ready for your book was entitled, Who Belongs Where? I love those three words because in a lot of ways, they are the essence of your book because you challenge exactly that question. So let me welcome you to the program. Tell my audience a little bit about your history, not just the author piece, because I think who you are is also relevant because it explains why you think about these things, because your life history made it obvious that it would be you that would want to write this book. Less Arnie Arneson from Brooklyn, New York, half Norwegian, half Italian, third generation, but definitely Sonia Shah. So tell my audience a little bit about you.
Yeah, thank you, Arnie. My parents are immigrants. They came over here to the U.S. in the 1960s, and I was born in New York, and always kind of had a sense of being out of place, which I think is not uncommon among a lot of, second-generation, first-generation immigrants in this country, especially if you look different, which I do, since, my parents are from South Asia. And I think I really incorporated that sense of out of placeness in how I located myself and my identity. Well, I never really called myself a, an American, you know, just a straight up American. It was always some kind of permutation of American, Asian American, South, you know, it varied over the years depending. But, and I never really felt like I belonged in any kind of American hometown, even though, you know, I've lived in some cities in the US for many, many years. You know, I was born in New York. I lived in Boston for over 10 years. I live in Baltimore now. I've lived here for over 10 years. I was never the person who felt comfortable cheering for the home team, you know, because I never felt like I was American enough to really claim my space on this continent. And I think I had internalized that idea that migration, this act of migration that my parents had undertaken, which was so central to their lives and has also been so central to my life, I internalized the idea of that act as disruptive, as sort of exceptional, anomalous, strange, you know, right? Like, so it's a weird thing that happened on the edges of history that my parents ended up moving here and I ended up living here. And that's why I always felt I don't belong here. I don't really belong in India either. I'm just sort of in this netherworld. And I think I incorporated that in my work as a science journalist too, because for many years, what has captured my attention is how when people and animals and microbes collide in new ways, that can cause these deadly and disruptive effects known as contagions, as we are living through right now. So the subject of my last book, as you mentioned, Arnie, Pandemic, was about emerging infectious diseases and how they can become pandemics. And that's all about how people on the move, populations on the move, animals on the move, microbes on the move, you know, when they interact in novel ways, that it can cause disease. And of course, that's what we're living through right now. But what I have come to understand in the writing of this last book is that I, you know, when you step back from looking up close at the disruptive effects of migration and you look at the bigger picture of, well, what is the role of migration in nature and in history more broadly, you know, you get a totally different picture. And so that's sort of what I wanted to interrogate in this book. That's a very long answer to your question.
It's a perfect door opener, because it was disruptive for you. You're trying to figure out, where is my place? I get that. My daughter has lived all over the world. She lives in Shanghai now. There isn't probably a country that she hasn't lived in for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. She sees the world as her oyster. She sees what she could benefit. She has wanted to absorb as much as possible. And now she's living in Shanghai. She's married a young man from China. So my world has changed because she has changed. Okay. So I am almost becoming part of the migrant, because I will migrate to China on a regular basis to see my grandchild. You know, that's going to be what's going to happen. I don't see that as a bad thing. I think it is a wonderful thing. I see it as a bridge builder. But at the same time, what you point out is that the term immigrant, migration, the fact that we see this kind of change as disruptive, we see it as more than as disruptive. We see it as negative. We see it as evil. We see it as a threat. You're absolutely right. And yet I didn't quite understand how that was possible, especially in a country like America, which there are Native Americans and we were the disruptors for them. There's no question. But we are a country that more than any other country in Europe and in Asia really represents the coming of all those disruptors, okay? And we wanted to sort of figure out, is there a way to sort of take all this disruption and make something great and make something positive? But you pointed out to a guy that was born in Sweden in 1707, and you tell the story of him because it turns out the way he viewed himself, the way he viewed the world, ultimately infected, or at least we can't blame him for all of it, but it infected how we perceive this kind of migration, this kind of change, and where so much of the negativity was sort of baked in to how he viewed this. Explain to my audience a little bit about a man I never knew about. And yet, as you played him out, I was like, oh God, of course, this begins to explain how we define terms in such a dark way.
So you're referring to the Swedish naturalist Carl Linnaeus. He's known today as the father of modern taxonomy. And he basically was the person who decided, you know, how we're going to classify the natural world. And he classified thousands and thousands of wild species. He also classified humans. And part of what he was doing was saying, well, where does everything belong? You know, which things belong in which places? He basically decided that everything he found belonged where he had found it. And the reason he did that is because he saw nature as an expression of God's perfection. This is in the, you know, in a time naturalists were almost all religious, right? They're all trying to describe how nature fits into the Christian tradition. What is the order of, you know, what is nature's order? How can we kind of delineate that? So that's what he was doing. In his idea of nature, everything was still. Everything had always been in its perfect place and always would stay in that perfect place in perfect balance because God put it there, right? So if you were to even say, well, maybe something might go extinct, maybe something might move, that was almost like a sacrilege because that was in a way saying, well, the place God put it wasn't perfect. So his whole conception of nature was that it was sedentary. It was absolutely still and unmoving. So he wasn't considering migration per se, but he erased it from nature by saying, well, if this maple tree grows in this one place, it is a Japanese maple, or this camel is found in the Middle East. It is from the Middle East. This is where it is. And we've incorporated that taxonomy into almost all of our sub-disciplines of biology. And we've incorporated into our conventional wisdom about nature. So you see very commonly those, you know, animal maps, people get them like for kids and books and stuff. And it's like, you know, the animal stands for the place. So the camel stands in for the Middle East.
Oh,
the kangaroo stands in for Australia. The bear stands in for, you know, as if those animals in those places are one and the same. So it just erases the idea that, well, maybe the camel has moved over time. And in fact, what we now know is that it has. It started out in North America. It's most prominent in South America. It's common in Australia. It's, you know, it's only domesticated in the Middle East. So this idea that the camel belongs in the Middle East or the kangaroo belongs in Australia, you know, all these ideas are really, I trace them all back to Linnaeus. And we still think of nature in that way today.
Let's make this a little more toxic because it isn't just about the tree belonging here and the camel belonging there. He also kind of looked at the human species. And let's talk about a little bit about the human species because we are fighting that right now.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. When I read your article, read the chapter about Linnaeus, I'm like punching the ceiling because, oh crap. Because when I'm looking at Black Lives Matter, I'm looking at the racism and I'm looking at the white supremacy and I'm looking at white privilege, I go back to Linnaeus. So tell my audience a little bit about what he saw with the idea of you belong there, not here.
He was putting his taxonomy together in this moment when Europe was first sort of expanding and trying to colonize the rest of the world. And so they encountered all these new kinds of people, new populations, and there's this big question, well, where do these people come from? Can they all have possibly descended from Adam and Eve and be perfect like us? And that seemed unbelievable because, you know, they looked different. They had different practices. They didn't, you know, for all of those reasons. And so Linnaeus basically decided that people belonged in their continents where they currently lived. And to such an extent, they had lived there for so long, had been so stable in those separate continents that they actually were separate subspecies. So he delineated a human taxonomy in which what we now know as the human races were actually subspecies, biologically distinct from each other. And he had different scientific names for people from Africa, people from Asia, people from Europe, people from the Americas. He also theorized privately, but this has come out in his papers, that he theorized, and this was very common among his peer group at that time, that people from Africa were a very distinct subspecies that were possibly subhuman. He thought that maybe they were a cross, a hybrid between real Homo sapiens and this other monstrous kind of humanoid that he called troglodytes. So he kind of characterized them as subhuman. But basically, he color-coded each human population to its continent, the black ones in Africa, the red ones in the Americas, the yellow ones in Asia, and the white ones in Europe. And then he arranged them in a hierarchy because, of course, during that time period, everything was in a hierarchy. You know, all of nature was in a hierarchy. Humans were in a hierarchy. So you couldn't have a categorization without putting it in a hierarchical order. So that's what he did. And that's been carried down to this day. I mean, you talk about the relevance, you know, we watched the horrible George Floyd video. And the thing that just went through my head is like that man with his knee on his neck, he's not with a grin on
his face. Human.
In his pocket. Yeah. This is how a person looks at someone who they don't think is the same as them. They don't have a shared humanity.
Well, I mean, think about what this leads to. Slavery, eugenics, ethnic cleansing, all these things that you were talking about. And I go back to that experiment, I don't know how many years ago, where, again, the idea that white is not only a priority, white is better than dark. Dark is, you know what I mean, this whole idea. And that study where you had little African-American children being given two dolls, a white doll and a black doll. And without fail, they would pick up the white doll. The white doll was better. The white doll was better. And so I'm reading this chapter and just everything is just sort of oozing out of me as I understand how he defined our terms. And by defining our terms, you see the economic consequences, the social consequences, the political consequences that we are still living with today, including, as you write, the next great migration. Migration is part of life on this planet. And therefore, in a way, I'm going to go back to Carl, and he saw everything, but he saw everything in his place. You see everything as movement.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, not just my personal opinion. It's based on the most cutting-edge science that we're learning about today with the advances in genetic technology and in GPS and navigational technology. This is allowing scientists to piece together the much more about what migration has meant on our planet. Our idea of our own migratory history has been that it's been intermittent, that, you know, we all originated in Africa and then we dispersed across into the different continents. And then we basically stayed still for millennia until this modern migration in the, you know, 19th and 20th century, because we had fast ships suddenly and then airplanes and all that. What scientists have pieced together now through analyzing ancient DNA is that we were moving all along. So even when we left Africa, there already were people dispersed out of the continents. We did what we always do when we move into new places and meet new people. We mated with them. We had wars with them. Their DNA is in our DNA. We mixed and assimilated and integrated and collided together. And then we didn't stop. People walked out of Africa into the Americas, walked back into Africa, walked back into Asia. From Asia, they went into Europe and then back to Asia and then into the Americas and back. Basically, what they're piecing together is the past migrations were just as complicated as today's are. So what we're seeing is that our migratory past was not intermittent. It was not, you know, anomalous in our continuous history. Our migration has been basically all along we've been migrating. It's been continuous.
I want everyone to turn to page 201 in your book, because that was the page that just completely jumped off the book. And you write, that's not what this mitochondrial DNA showed. According to the genetics analysis, the 147 women of different racial and continental backgrounds had shared common ancestors as recently as 200,000 years ago. If true, the long period of isolation that scientists had presumed for centuries did not exist. Did not exist. I read that and I'm like, oh my God. But again, it's been so baked in, Sonia, that your book is so remarkable, because it challenges so much of what has been baked in to our sort of understanding of this. But let me throw something out today about how we can now easily move. We can take a plane, we can take a train, but people almost have a greater connection to place because of wealth. They don't want you to touch their land or touch their house. They have an investment in that building. So in a lot of ways, what has sort of made it more frightening to think about movement, even though it may be out of necessity, is what you think you have to give up in order to move. So in a bizarre way, you know, nomadic tribes have it over us. They've understood that connection to the planet. We don't understand the connection to the planet. We understand the connection to Concord, New Hampshire, or New York, New York. And that's not how the world is. And you're telling us we need to kind of reconsider and rethink how the world is if we're to survive, frankly, Sonia.
There's undeniably disruptions and loss with any change, right? Not just migration, any kind of change. There's loss, there's disruption. And I don't think it's necessarily only wealthy people who don't want to move. I think people are connected to their land, you know, I mean,
their neighbors, their family, all those
things. Their neighbors, their families, their way of life, the way they used to farm, their, you know, all of those things. Absolutely. But what we also know is that we are entering a period of rapid change. Right? That's what the climate crisis is bringing to us. And we see how other species are responding. 80% of wild species are moving into new places. Wildlife biologists and the people who are watching that are glad because they see that as life-saving, because it is. If we want to retain biodiversity, we need to allow these creatures to move. Instead of building parks for them, we should be building bridges for them so that they can move into new places, new corridors. And we are starting to do that. But we have to look at ourselves, our own history too. All of us are entering a period in which the stability of our environment is not necessarily as long as it takes to raise the next generation. So you can't assume that your children will have the same way of life as you do in terms of the climate and the geography around you.
But unless we read your book, unless we understand that, we're going to build walls. I live in an old 1890 Queen Anne Victorian, and I inherited it, so I'll apologize now. Anyway, but what I love about my basement, okay, remember this was built in 1899. They have something called French drains. And what is that? There's water that they knew would come into the basement. So rather than try to stop the water, they created this drainage system so the water would come in the basement and then it would flow out. Well, a lot of my neighbors said, oh, we're going to cement over our basement. We're going to make it solid. We're going to make it. Well, guess what? They blew out their foundation. You know, and Arnie's chuckling because she's got the drains. You know what I mean? But that's movement. That's migration. That is respecting nature, not fearing it, but respecting it. I wanted to make sure that you had it in your book, but I remember when we were talking about climate change and the Pentagon and all this other stuff, I remember talking to one of the candidates for president, and I said, why don't you refer to them to what's happening in Syria? And he goes, what? And I said, climate change and a drought is in part what happened in Syria when the farmers left the places where they couldn't grow crops and they came into a city that wasn't prepared for the thousands and thousands of people. I mean, when you see the calamity of not understanding what's happening, suddenly having to face this enormous change so you're threatened by it, and then you see the political and economic and war consequences of not having understood what was going to lead to this. You give us a new way of looking at things, which means we can anticipate and not fear it.
Yeah, I think that's right, Arnie, but I think it's also about being resilient to change. You know, this example you brought up about Syria, and I do talk about that in my book, it's not predetermined, right? That, yes, there was a drought. Yes, people had to leave their fields because they're drying up and move into the cities. But then what happened? Okay, the political leadership decided, well, we're not going to prop up food prices. We're not going to make allowances for these people. We're not going to manage the civil strife in a nonviolent fashion. You know, there's all these political choices made along the way, just like whoever built your house decided to build the French drains as opposed to building walls. You know, these are intentional choices we can make. So it's not predetermined that, yes, change is going to happen, but it's not a deterministic process that necessarily means we're going to have crisis and catastrophe and disruptive migrations that are done all at once in a really fast-paced way where we can't absorb them. We can manage all of this, right? Like instead of saying, no, let's build walls, nobody can move, we can say, look, people are going to have to move, but let's try to make it, you know, so that we can get the benefits from it and minimize the costs. Let's change the pace. Let's make it easier. Let's make it less dangerous. There's all these ways in which we can manage it as a reality that is around us, as opposed to a phenomenon we're trying to block.
And it's an opportunity, Sonia. Again, it's the language that we use to describe the events that are happening. We can be afraid of something. We can use all this dark language. We can make it a negative. We can fear them and want to keep them out. Or we can absorb it and see the opportunity. My stepson used to work in New York City. He worked for the Tenement Museum. And the Tenement Museum is about really the evolution of change in New York City. And everyone goes and goes, I didn't know. But it made us a better place because of those waves of immigrants that came in. That kind of education is important as we face such a challenging future. If we don't give people a different way of looking at it, we will embrace a wall. And yet the wall will blow up just the way the foundations blow up on my friends' houses when they cemented over their basement, because you can't stop it. The question is, can you understand it? Can you anticipate it? And can you figure out a way to embrace it? And as you point out, even find the amazing opportunity. 40 to 70% you have in your book of species have moved. They've had to relocate because of climate change. Well, they didn't relocate because they wanted to live, you know, maybe 100 miles north, but that was now a more accommodating climate and they could thrive and survive. Well, we're a species too. The question is, how do we thrive and survive? Sonia Shah, I don't know what's in your brain, but I want to be right there because I love where you go next. The title of her piece, The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Moon. Move. I have this moon concept. Let me read that again. The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. I think I may be getting ready to move to the moon. Who knows? Thank you so much for writing this. And your timeliness is absolutely perfection. I think in light of what happens in November of 2020, we may have this as recommended reading. So thank you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow. You better think.